Hey, everyone. It's Here and Now producer Chris Bentley.
And Here and Now co-host Scott Tong. Hey, Chris, what have you been up to?
Well, Scott, I've been working on something that I'm excited to tell you and our listeners about. It's a new version of our podcast.
Ooh.
Dropping into the Here and Now feed next week. And I'll be hosting it for the time being.
Oh, I love it. Now, just so you know, everyone, our reporters and co-hosts you know and you love, we'll still bring you the news, analysis, arts, culture, everything the light touches. But our podcast is going to be curated by Chris and his team, and it will deliver our best stories, right?
Yeah, that's right. We're going to rely on the same great journalism and storytelling that our producers and hosts and editors produce every day.
Mm-hmm.
Deep stories that you can't hear anywhere else, as well as some exclusive things that you won't hear on our radio show.
Okay, so if you want to hear everything from our show, go to hereandnow.org.
And for this fancy new podcast, Scott, you can just find it right here in the same feed starting next week.
I'll be there. Chris, thank you.
Thanks, Scott. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston. It's Here and Now. King Charles III addressed the world today for the first time as his country's monarch, following the death yesterday of his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, paying tribute to her.
To my darling mama, as you begin your last great journey to join my dear late papa, I want simply to say this. Thank you. Thank you for your love and devotion to our family and to the family of nations you have served so diligently all these years. May flights of angels sing thee to thy rest.
Earlier, he stopped to shake hands and accept the condolences of people gathered outside of Buckingham Palace. Joining us to talk about Queen Elizabeth's legacy and King Charles III are Julian Zelizer, professor of history at Princeton University, and Femi Okay, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera. Hello to you both. Great to have you.
Hello.
Nice to be with you.
Julian, I'll start with you. What did you hear in King Charles's speech today?
Well, it was a moving address about the death at a personal level, but there is an element of watching a new king in 2022, which is a reminder of kind of this outdated institution and what it means to be living in this era and still have a relic from a very different period in European history, in political history, in world history that has changed so dramatically since the time she had become queen.
Femi, do you think that Charles will be able to command the stage and attention and respect the way his mother did?
It is an impossible role to move on from and to take over from. I was just thinking, Celeste, I was getting condolences from people all over the world as if the queen was my grandmother rather than my former queen. And I've always been able to say the queen, and everybody knows who I'm talking about, who we're talking about. I don't think we'd be able to say the king. We'd have to say King Charles, and then people will understand who we're talking about. Mm. So that level of fame, celebrity, respect, he doesn't have that, but he is going to try and forge his own way. And you begin to see it a little bit in the way that he has slimmed down the royal family, made it more about a particular number of members of the royal family, not a huge, big family doing public events, but focusing very tightly on just a small group. So I feel like that those were the early seeds of what will it be like during King Charles's reign?
Julian, I want to talk to you a little bit about Queen Elizabeth's sort of her legacy. She was born almost in the full bloom of the British Empire. She died in post-Brexit Britain. Is her death the end of an era? And if so, what is that era? How do we define that era?
Yeah, I mean, that era ended before her death. I think she was an interesting figure in that she had this role as the world around her changed. She is the queen as decolonization takes place, throughout the 1950s and 60s, and the sun does set on the British Empire. She was in this position during the era of television, and part of what we're discussing was her effectiveness at operating in this new medium to command the attention of the world in many ways. And already, the monarchy was something very different during her lifetime and certainly at the time of her death than it had been in the early 1950s. It's really a totally ceremonial entity for many people. And so I think it's not that her death brings all of this. I think she marked the end of the era, and now the question is what happens in subsequent decades with this institution?
I mean, speaking of changing times, Femi, even since the Queen died yesterday, there has been a difference in reactions around the world. We obviously cannot forget that Britain's colonial past, which many people see the monarchy as a symbol of that past, is something that Elizabeth never apologized for. I mean, you yourself are a first-generation immigrant to the UK. You're the daughter of parents who were born in Nigeria while it was still ruled by the British. What's on your mind?
So this is really painful because you respectfully appreciate the service that the Queen gave to her country, gave to many, many other former colonial countries around the world. But behind that is so much pain. And what I was seeing, if you think about what's online as the filter that's taken off and what we're doing on the air is we have the filter. But the filter was off yesterday. And there were two big conversations happening that I was observing online. And one was from people from Ireland. And one was from people from former colonies, black and brown people around the world. And there was deep pain because the Queen represents the legacy of the British Empire. Let me give you an idea from Tom Nolan. This really struck me as I was reading this. Never forget that every single colonizing tactic the British used to enslave half the world was first honed to a fine edge on the Irish island. Tonight, we celebrate and drink to the death of colonizers. That is really painful. There are history lessons that are popping up online, on Twitter, from former colonies in the African continent, in India, where people are deeply upset, still see the legacy of colonialism, and the fact that the UK, the Queen, kind of addressed it, but didn't apologise for subjugating so many millions of people around the world. There is pain, as well as the mourning for the Queen, but pain for what her legacy has left behind.
Julian, let me get your thoughts on this. I was found it interesting that King Charles, now I almost said Prince, sort of obliquely referred to this, saying that she began her rule while they were still, Britain was suffering the privations of World War II, and under the conventions of earlier times, he said. What do you think about this next era for Britain and whether or not we will see the royal family deal with colonial past more directly?
Well, I think they have to. I think these conversations, by the way, are fine to have. They happen when U.S. presidents pass away or public figures. You often have this period where, of course, you're mourning and you're respectful, but given their public nature, the inevitable discussions emerge of the bad things that happened during their time. And I think it would not be the right direction if her passing is simply about celebration and nostalgia, but it also should be a moment of reckoning. And it can be done in different ways, but I think going forward, this is important because of the era we are living in. These are not old conventions anymore that are acceptable. And I think, Britain only gets stronger if it starts to deal with these elements of the past.
I'm so glad you said that, but you're saying that as somebody who's outside of the United Kingdom, that ability to have that bold conversation, to really talk about race and racism and prejudice, we're much more comfortable pretending and being polite to each other that it's not happening than really addressing it full on. It's a conversation that needs to happen. There's been a lot more racism, racist attacks since the United Kingdom left Brexit. Those are facts, those are statistics. But will the UK feel able to have that conversation, that honest conversation about what's left over from the British Empire and why this incredibly multicultural country is still struggling with racism when that country went out and formed its empire from the black and brown people around the world?
That's interesting. Julian, to Femi's point, Julian, do you think this transition with Queen Elizabeth dying and the accession of a new king is going to open the possibility to having that conversation, perhaps?
I think it might. I mean, look, some of the obstacles are pretty well entrenched, and it's not simply a desire not to have the conversations or just for civility's sake. I think there's a lot of people invested in the status quo who don't want to have those conversations because they would be unsettling. Again, not unlike what we see in the United States. But yes, I think one of the elements of the Queen, of the monarchy in this day and age, is that it's something of a unifying force. And so as it diminishes, or as the figure who still figured out a way to maintain that role, even though it doesn't really, you know, make sense in the minds of many people in this day and age, as she has passed, if he doesn't fill the role in the same way, I do think there could be more opportunity for more honest conversations and reforms that flow from that.
All right.
Do you feel like, do you feel like I feel that actually talking about the reign of King Charles sounds so anachronistic? And I'm British. It sounds weird, doesn't it?
Even
watching the news of a new king, there is that feeling.
We're going to have to leave it there. It's been so great having both of you. Julian Zelizer, professor of history at Princeton University, and Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera. Thank you both so much.
Thanks
for
having
us. You're very welcome.
It's been a week of withering heat in the American West. Some areas have seen 100-degree temperatures in September for the first time ever. Climate forecasts project more heat waves in the future, so air conditioning is becoming a necessity in places where people have never needed it before. Here's Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton.
You got like 16 fans going.
Alyssa Alsop lives in a subsidized apartment complex just 17 miles from Glacier National Park. There's no air conditioning here, and she says it's been so hot inside, her 1.5-year-old daughter has been sick.
And then she started puking every night, probably a good 3 times a night, and I'm like, she's too hot. I would give her 3-4 cold baths, but how many times can I do that?
Elsop eventually took her daughter to the emergency room because she couldn't stop vomiting. Kathy Whitlock, a Montana State University professor who wrote Montana's climate change assessment, says some are suffering more than others.
It affects the old and the very young, people far from services, people with health conditions, people who live in poverty that don't have access to cooling systems.
Whitlock says summers like these will only become more common in climate models.
So that covers large areas of Montana, and I think it's probably our number one concern about climate change going forward.
Amy Sillenberg at the nonprofit Climate Smart Missoula is trying to help spur heat adaptation in Montana. Cooling centers don't really work in rural areas with dispersed populations, so more people will need home air conditioning.
It's not just a comfort thing. It's actually essential to have the ability to cool the place that you sleep, right?
Sillenberg has been working on helping low-income people get AC for about a year, but
how do we actually fund this?
The most climate-friendly option is heat pumps, which also provide air conditioning but can cost thousands of dollars.
It's complicated, and these new heat pumps cost money. So that's where the Inflation Reduction Act is just really exciting.
The Inflation Reduction Act President Biden signed last month earmarks $4.3 billion for rebates to help low- and middle-income homeowners swallow the upfront cost of installing a heat pump. Sillenberg's organization is preparing to help people navigate the new rebates and pick up additional costs. And a little AC makes a big difference. Alyssa Alsop in Columbia Falls was finally able to install a window air conditioning unit, despite it being against her apartment complex rules.
We put that in yesterday and it feels a lot better in here.
Yeah, how hot was it getting in? in here?
I would say more than probably 100 degrees. It was to the point where you couldn't sit in here.
Elsop says with the cool air blowing, her daughter slept through the night without puking for the first time in days. Whether the Inflation Act's incentives will lead landlords to outfit more apartments like Elsop's with air conditioning remains to be seen. Diego Rivas with the nonprofit Northwest Energy Coalition says the federal government is still hashing out exactly what those incentives will look like.
But hopefully with the IRA, these investments become, you know, cost neutral, so to speak.
How effective the legislation is in helping Montanans get air conditioning depends on how much this Republican state cooperates with the Biden White House, whether they can efficiently help people and landlords access the federal funding with minimum hassle. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Bolton in Columbia Falls, Montana.
50 years ago tomorrow, an American runner made history at the Summer Olympics in Munich. The 1972 Games also made history as the scene of a tragic terrorist attack. Alex Ashlock has the story.
Frank Shorter was 24 years old when he won the Olympic marathon on September 10, 1972, the first American winner of that event since 1908.
Frank Shorter appears to be running to victory in the marathon through the streets of his old hometown. There he is between those trucks. And his old hometown is Munich, West Germany. He was born here, but he only lived here for a few months when his father was an army doctor.
Jim McKay's coverage on ABC that day sounds idyllic, but the 1972 Olympics were anything but.
Arab terrorists armed with submachine guns, faces blackened, a couple of them disguised as guards or as trash men in the Olympic Village, climbed the fence, went to the headquarters of the Israeli team and immediately killed one man, Moshe Weinberg, a coach, two shots in the head, one in the stomach. And the latest report is that one more has been killed.
The world watched as what became a hostage crisis dragged on for hours. In the end, a rescue mission failed and 11 Israeli athletes were dead. The games were paused for a day, but after a memorial service, the competition continued and Shorter won gold. The 50th anniversary of that day, though, is bittersweet for Shorter, because his good friend Kenny Moore, who finished fourth in that Olympic marathon and who would go on to write wonderful stories about running, died on May 4th. I spoke with Frank Shorter recently at his home in Falmouth, Massachusetts. When the terrorist attack started, he was on a balcony outside the U.S. runner's apartment in the Olympic Village.
I was out sleeping on a mattress that I pulled out, and it was about 4 in the morning. And I heard what I first thought, because it woke me up, was a door slam. Wow, that door. And I said, no, that's not a door slamming. And I just knew. I knew it was shots. And the other thing I'll never forget, I was lying there, and there was a balcony. You couldn't see through. You had to stand up and look down onto the Olympic Village. And I think we were about the fourth floor. And usually by the time I would get up, because I sleep late, there was all sorts of noise and bustle, you know, that I was sleeping through down on the paths, on the streets below, and it was silent. And the way I describe it is it was just like the jungle when there's a predator. There's no sound.
They have now said that there were 11 hostages. Two were killed in their rooms yesterday morning. 9 were killed at the airport tonight. They're all gone.
We thought the games were over. Because the feeling was, nothing's worth human life. This is done. We're going home.
There was a debate within the American team about going home. Here's Shorter's teammate, the late Kenny Moore, on what was said.
Frank was the eloquent one then. He said, we have to spread the word by performance that barbarism only makes Olympians stronger. We have to say, this is as scared as I get, and let's go run.
After the memorial service, we were walking back to the athletes' village, and I said to Kenny, I said, Kenny, you know, the only other place that any terrorist can do anything here is on the marathon course. And I said, you know, I get chills when I think about it. I said, I am not going to think about it. Because if I do, they win. You know, we have to run. Because if we don't, they win. And I can tell you, I ran that whole race and never thought about it.
Shorter's training and strategy played out perfectly. He was used to throwing in a surge in the middle of a long workout, running very fast for a minute or so before slowing down and recovering. And in the Olympic marathon, he did the same thing, 9 miles in to the 26.2-mile race.
I hope it's not arrogant, but I remember breaking away and looking behind, and everybody after about 20 seconds was like 30 yards behind me. And I said, ooh, I feel pretty good. And I said, if I were back there, I think I should be up there with him. But they didn't. And so by 20 miles, I had a minute and 15 second lead. And by the end, it was over 2 minutes.
We heard from your friend and teammate, Kenny Moore, earlier when he talked about the debate that you guys had over whether you should continue in the Olympics, whether the Olympics should go on. And he wrote this great story after the Olympics, and he's writing about you and he the day after you won the gold medal. And he says to you, you know, all this time I thought the Olympic champion was somebody incredibly special. And then he goes on to write, Frank gave me a consoling look as though he would have liked to protect me from this final disillusionment. And then he quotes you saying, and then you found out that it was only me. Kenny died earlier this year, and I just wondered what you think about when you hear those words that he wrote in 1973 and about him today.
I will admit, I had actually forgotten that.
I know it's hard.
Because we were equals. Or maybe I wasn't even his equal. You know, we all have moments in time where, you know, I'll say it, God can have things happen. And you have to be not only thankful, but in wonder that it can happen. And I can remember what I was going to try to explain to him was all the reasons why I just had a perfect day, and it happened to be the Olympics.
4 years later at the Summer Olympics in Montreal, Shorter nearly had another perfect day, but he had to settle for a silver medal, beaten in the marathon by an East German runner who was later implicated in the state-sponsored use of performance-enhancing drugs by that country's athletes. Shorter would become a leading figure in the anti-doping movement in sports. Shorter will be 75 years old next month. He's still running. In fact, a few days after we spoke, he ran the Falmouth Road Race, an event that was actually inspired by his gold medal win in Munich 50 years ago. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
The world's second largest movie theater chain is in financial crisis. Cineworld filed for bankruptcy this week. The British-based company operates more than 500 theaters as Regal Cinemas in the U.S., and it was battered by the pandemic. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg, joins us now. Mike, great to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So Cineworld is loaded down with billions of dollars of debt. Just how bad do the books look at this big global theater chain? How bad is the situation?
Well, you know, obviously very bad if they are taking the drastic step of filing for bankruptcy protection. They basically have about $5 billion in debt, $5 billion with a B, and only $4 million with an M in cash on hand. So that's a pretty untenable situation and explains why they went to bankruptcy court, basically trying to renegotiate with their creditors and reduce that debt burden, cancel some of the debt, perhaps change the terms of it as well, to make it more realistic that they can pay back their creditors.
So I'm reading that a judge allowed the company to access $785 million in emergency funding. Is that enough of a lifeline to keep it going for now? Or are they looking at having to close down the road or soon?
So, yeah, when you're in bankruptcy protection like this, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to shut down operations. And the Cineworld says they should be able to continue running operations without interruption. And that $785 million is part of a bankruptcy financing package of almost $2 billion that they say they have secured. So there is some more sort of emergency funding available to them, assuming the judge approves that further down the line. So for now, it looks like they should be able to keep the movies rolling in the theaters. You know, the longer term future of the company is a little more uncertain about how they're going to sort of restructure the business after this. But for now, they say they should be able to continue operations without interruption.
So before the pandemic, movie theaters were packed. And I'm wondering how much of does this have to do with COVID and the way COVID essentially hit the entire industry?
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely the main reason for this. Part of the reason Cineworld has so much debt is that purchase of the Regal Cinemas in the U.S., which they borrowed a lot of money to accomplish. Completely, obviously, not expecting that the COVID pandemic would come along and basically shut down movie theaters for a few months there. Completely, you know, box office revenue literally went to zero in the U.S. for a few weeks there. You know, this is their attempt to sort of survive that, to reemerge from that. But COVID clearly was the biggest catalyst for this turn of events for them.
Big catalyst, but of course, new streaming services mean a lot more competition for customers. If Cineworld is able to emerge from bankruptcy, what does the long-term future look like? I mean, how will Cineworld adapt to this new landscape, I guess?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that it's a very big challenge, not only streaming services. You know, younger people today are much more into social media, TikTok, and that sort of thing. So there's all sorts of competition that was not facing the film industry in years past. So, you know, they've got their work cut out for them to sort of thrive in this new environment.
Right. Big challenge. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
It's been a week of tragedy and grief for the Cree Nation in Saskatchewan, Canada, following a stabbing spree that killed 10 people and injured another 18 on Sunday. The suspects are both dead. Damian Sanderson was found dead Monday near the scene of the attacks. His brother Miles died in police custody after his arrest Wednesday. The end of the manhunt brought some relief to residents of the James Smith Cree Nation Reservation in the nearby town of Weldon, where the killings took place. But many are still traumatized. Tribal Chief Mark Arcand is the head of the Saskatoon Tribal Council. His sister Bonnie and his nephew Gregory were both killed in the attack. And he joins us now. And a warning, this conversation will include some descriptions of the violent events that took place. And Tribal Chief Arcand, thank you for being here. We are very, very sorry for your loss.
Thank you very much. It really means a lot.
Well, we understand that this must be hard to talk about, but tell us, if you can, how you found out about the stabbings. We understand that you were a few hours away.
Yeah, absolutely. First and foremost, I just want to say this is about my sister. It's not about my title as tribal chief. It's our family that's devastated and crushed by two of our family members being killed on Sunday. I woke up Sunday morning to an alert by the RCMP on our phones, and I read on there James Smith Cree Nation, and first thing I thought of was my sister. 15 or so minutes later, I was getting texts, call family. So I called, and they informed me my sister was one of the victims, my sister and my nephew.
Mm.
I jumped in my vehicle, and I drove 2 hours, one of the longest 2 hours in my life, wondering, waiting. I got to the community about 1 o'clock.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you specifically about your sister and your nephew, but what did you see when you arrived in your sister's village?
When I arrived at my sister's house, I seen police, I seen forensic units, I seen three bodies outside, one being my sister, one being my nephew, and the lady that came out to help that was killed trying to help my sister. My first reaction when I got there was anger. Through my 2 hours of driving, it was to go and see my sister and hug her and hold her and tell her we love her, and we couldn't do that. That's the saddest part, right?
I can understand, indeed. It's tragic. So your sister, Bonnie Goodvoice Burns, died along with her oldest son, Gregory. And I understand that another nephew was stabbed in the neck. Let's start with your sister. Help us remember your sister.
Well, she was a Dakota woman. She had 4 kids. She raised 2 foster kids. She had a wonderful husband. They've been together for 15 years. In our culture, the First Nations culture, she was a matriarch of our family. She was always there for the kids. She had a beautiful home. She is, I've said, she raised 2 foster kids that weren't hers, supporting community events. Anytime they needed volunteers, she was there. That's what we remember her as. She was always laughing, caring, just put everybody else first before herself. And it doesn't go unnoticed.
Now, speaking of that, do I have this right that your nephew was attacked first and your sister came out to try to help, to try to intervene, and was fatally wounded? Is that right?
So these individuals, they invaded her home. They went in through, I think, a window in the back, and they attacked Gregory. They also attacked my sister inside. She was stabbed in the neck somewhere, and she was her 13-year-old and her other 2 boys seen her holding a towel to stop the bleeding. And her oldest boy went outside, and I think they attacked him some more. I'm not sure how bad. We've never seen the autopsy report or the coroner's report yet. And she went outside to help him, and they attacked her again, and that other innocent lady, and they both died in the driveway, right outside of her door, with the kids still in the house. The 13-year-old was stabbed, trying to keep his other brothers in the bedroom. Mm. And one of the, I think it was the 11-year-old, I was hiding behind the high chair watching this all unfold in the kitchen. And it's the trauma that these kids have faced is unbelievable. And that's what we're focusing on right now, is try to help this family. The husband is now a single father.
Right. Well, as we mentioned, Bonnie and Gregory were among 10 people killed on Sunday. Chief Arcan, do you have any idea what led to this attack? Any understanding of the motive? Are you thinking about that at all?
Always been thinking about it. Just don't have answers. The people that were involved in it are dead. We're trying to piece it together through our 13-year-old nephew's eyes, but it's hard for him to talk. And we're not worried about that at this point. But right, we're hoping, you know, when this individual got caught, maybe he'd tell us why he did it, right? And kind of get some closure in there. But I guess that doesn't come to fruition because he passed on.
Yeah.
So we may never get answers. That's sad. But at the same time, it's not going to stop us from healing and trying to move forward, because we've got to take care of these kids.
Now, you mentioned another woman who died of her injuries, 61-year-old Gloria Burns. She counseled people dealing with drug, alcohol, and gaming addiction. She raised 5 adopted children as a single mother. She also ran sweat lodge ceremonies. She was a respected tribal elder. Do you want to tell us a little more about her role in the community?
So, to be respectful to the families, I don't speak on behalf of the other families at all.
I understand.
But I think at the same point, you hit the nail on the head. And how Gloria was involved in my sister's death was, Gloria's job was, I guess, in the city, was like a community first responder, I guess. And that's how Gloria came over. She was trying to help my sister, and she got killed.
You know, it occurs to me as I think about the pain that you're going through, and it's unimaginable. And again, I'm so sorry that you're going through this, but I'm thinking of you processing this not only as a grieving brother and uncle, but also as the head of Saskatoon's tribal council. So this is about family. It's also about an entire community. What does your community need right now? How are you thinking about that?
Well, there's a two-step process for us. First and foremost, it's always family that comes for us as First Nations people. So right now, we're focused on a GoFundMe page for my sister to actually get these three boys into some really serious therapy to really deal with this, because the 13-year-old is really traumatized and the two boys below them are, they're not themselves. You can see it. The second piece is, we're supporting the community of James Smith in the city of Saskatoon, which is about 2 hours away, because there's still victims in the hospital. And we're supporting them through our organization at three different locations. There's close to 80 people from different families that are here going to hospital each and every day. Some of them fleeing with nothing. We even got one guy glasses because he left in a moment's notice without his glasses. So the best thing we tell people, if they want to give, maybe it's a monetary donation. Yesterday in the city, we had a birthday party for one of the 8-year-old kids. That's the kind of stuff we're doing. We're putting the humanity side first of the people. And that's what my sister wanted.
Chief, let me ask you this finally. I know it's early and I know you're dealing with an immense amount of grief. Can you imagine a time when your communities can recover from this tragedy?
I have not been thinking about that because I think about all the people that are hurting right now. In our First Nations way, we haven't been able to do it in our cultural way, which is sacred fires, you know, bring people home, right? So this grieving process is going to take a while. And when I think about the long-term situation, I always think about my nephews first, because the trauma that they've seen and the trauma that they've endured is unspeakable. Nobody asked for this. Nobody had expected this. Think about this. Each and one of us have a home. We're supposed to feel safe in that home. And right now, these kids, they can't even return home. Pretty serious stuff.
Pretty serious indeed. Well, that's Tribal Chief Mark Arcand. He's the head of the Saskatoon Tribal Council. His sister Bonnie and his nephew Gregory were among those killed in the attack on Sunday. Chief Arcand, thank you again. Again, our condolences.
Thank you very much, Anthony, and be safe out there.
And if you'd like to make a donation to help this community, or if you're struggling with trauma and would like to talk with someone, you can find links at our website, hereandnow.org.
We thought we'd take just a moment to remember. Sunday marks the 21st anniversary of the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Almost 3,000 people died. Just a couple of months later, attorney Kenneth Feinberg was appointed the special master of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund set up by Congress. He and his associates had to decide what a life was worth and then convince family members to accept that assessment. That story and Feinberg's 2005 book, What is a Life Worth?, are the basis of the Netflix film Worth. Michael Keaton played Kenneth Feinberg, Amy Ryan, his office administrator, Camille Byros.
Most of the people who died that day were providers for their families. We can't bring them back, but we can help their loved ones pay their bills.
Now you people understand we're not going to be able to haggle every case subjectively. That's where the math comes in. So we're going to need a rubric.
But as the pair learned, people are not rubrics. They met with many of the victims' families before making their determinations. Camille Byros and Kenneth Feinberg spoke with Robin Young about the film last September when Worth was released. Let's hear some of it.
This law came about quickly. Then a lot of things weren't thought through, like what about a fiancé who was about to get married to someone who dies in the towers? And the parents of that young man surface, and they cut the fiancé out. Or a same-sex couple, Camille.
This was one of the most difficult aspects of doing this. There was no same-sex marriage. Legitimate couples who were living together, the family had to agree to allow us to allocate a portion of their compensation to the same-sex partner. In many cases, the same-sex partner was the first person notified of the deceased's passing.
Well, in fact, there's a story in the film. Not only was the boyfriend of a young man who was killed the first notified, he was notified by the young man just before he died in the towers. He had a voicemail, and yet your commitment was to what? The law of each state.
That's exactly right. Unless, of course, we can convince the family to agree.
Ken, how did you do this? The stories. The woman whose family sat with what they thought was their loved one a burn victim. There were very few survivors, but this was one. And they sat for 4 days in the hospital with this man wrapped in gauze. It turns out it was not their loved one who died alone in another hospital bed. I mean, how?
Absolutely debilitating to this day. It takes its toll. But I must say that the one thing that girded us and helped us get through all of this was the fact that the entire country spoke as one. There wasn't any red state, blue state, liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat. This program 20 years ago is like time out of mind today. I don't know if we could ever do this today. 20 years ago, the Bush administration, with the complete support of Senator Kennedy and the Democrats and the Congress, quickly enacted this.
And appointed you, who had been the top aide to the Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy, to administer it.
That's right. And of course, I remember Mitch Daniels, who at the time was the head of OMB, Office of Management and Budget, saying to me, we don't want to appoint anybody who's close to President Bush. This could be an unmitigated disaster.
I want to make sure we've pointed out, Camille, that there were some people who were astonished that the American people were offering them any money. Undocumented workers that you met with whose loved ones died in the building, they were foreign nationals.
I think that's right. And finding and convincing the 11 undocumented families to come into this program was no easy feat. They were petrified that they would be deported.
I mean, it's just astonishing. There were 60 pregnant widows that you spoke with.
It was incredibly difficult, and not just with the families of the deceased. Ken and I met with a gentleman who did escape, but he was burned over 95% of his body. And after having gone through 35 separate operations, came to our office with his medical team and his oxygen and his physicians. It was just horrifying.
Not the calculation, the dollars, the numbers. Judges and juries do that every day in every court in the country. But as Camille points out, the emotion, the pathos, the actual face-to-face visits, that really took its toll, but we managed to get through it.
You say, Kenneth, people always ask you, how did administering this fund change you? And you kind of like, oh, why do people? And I agree, what a stupid question. So I'm going to ask you anyway. Not only how did it change you, but do you find yourself thinking this week in particular about them?
Oh, you think about them every day. The number of stories we heard about people who were in the World Trade Center for the first time that morning. They had never been there, and they died there. Or the number of people who said, that one day I was delayed 1 hour. They lived, others died. The serendipitous nature of life and death can't help but make you rather fatalistic about getting up in the morning and living each day like it might be your last. You can't help but think that way.
Kenneth Feinberg and Camille Byros talking about their work for the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. This Sunday marks the 21st anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Anthony Brooks in Boston. It's Here and Now.